Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriventfinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. Gas prices have been skyrocketing out of control for a while, right? Not so fast.
Gasoline prices in particular were low for a very long time. Even until a few weeks ago, they were at about 1980-81 levels.
That's Peter Hong with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. He says the reason gas has seemed so expensive for so long is because we have to buy more of it than we used to. Our question, why is that? Is it because A, our cars guzzle more? A modern Honda Accord has as much horsepower as a 1990 Porsche. Or is it B, complex modern engines are harder to keep properly tuned? Or maybe the culprit is C, traffic. We spend more time and gas money going nowhere. Take your pick and stick around for the answer on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. The government released the latest inflation figures this week, and surprise! But have you ever noticed that when the Consumer Price Index is reported, it comes with a caveat, and it's a big one? I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
So when this CPI figure comes out each month, the Consumer Price Index, there's something that economists pay attention to called core inflation, inflation without food and energy costs factored in. They say it's because those prices are so volatile that they can't accurately reflect overall prices. But anyone who's gone to the grocery store or filled up at the gas pump lately knows that those are two of the biggest expenditures we have. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find the logic in this monthly number.
Just in case you have a hard time keeping your economic indicators straight, let's do a quick review. The Consumer Price Index, or CPI, is supposed to be a way to measure how much it costs to live. So imagine filling a grocery cart with everything you spend your money on. Food, housing, clothes, transportation, you name it. Every month, the economists over at the Bureau of Labor Statistics take all those costs and compare them to last month or last year, which in turn is supposed to tell us how much inflation there is. How accurate is the index? Ask Ken Boschman, an economist at Global Insight.
Well, that largely depends on who you are and where you live and, you know, what you typically spend your money on. So if your expenditures line up fairly closely with the mix that's reflected in the CPI, then it's going to do a fairly good job.
The government tries to find ways to make the CPI more accurate for everybody. For instance, it tries to take into account changes in spending habits or substitutions when consumers buy chicken because beef is too expensive. The Federal Reserve uses the CPI to gauge inflation, but doesn't count what it considers volatile figures like energy costs and food. Some economists think that's absurd. John Williams runs an economics website called Shadow Stats.
I challenge you to find anyone who does not consume food or energy. And if you consume food and energy, looking at annual inflation, including food and energy, is legitimate, and saying that you don't have to count food and energy is absolute nonsense. That's not reflective of anyone's cost of living or anyone's inflation.
There are plenty of other criticisms about the CPI, such as that housing costs aren't accurately represented, especially in this market. But Ian Shepherdson of High Frequency Economics has a more benign take.
I would say that it's probably the least bad of the bunch.
He says the CPI is about as accurate an inflation indicator as you can get. The real problem, he says, is the cost of food and energy are going up disproportionately fast right now.
When food and energy prices rise in a big, sustained way, you just have to grit your teeth and accept that it makes you poorer. Sometimes there's nothing you can do about it.
Which means, in the end, that inflation's in the eye or in the pocketbook of the beholder. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
The government may insist on removing food and energy from the equation, but we all know that prices for just about everything are going up. Or are they? Turns out some of the stuff we buy is actually just as cheap or even cheaper than it was a generation ago. Peter Hong is a business writer for the Los Angeles Times, and a few days ago he wrote about the reality of our expenses. He joins us in the studio. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Your story starts out with you, I think, trying to convince people that stuff isn't as expensive as we might think it is. You say, stuff is cheap. Really?
Yeah, stuff really is cheap. Stuff in kind of the George Carlin sense of stuff, consumer products. And I think in the story you saw that I referred to an ad from our newspaper in 1978 for Sears.
For the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah.
And you have that with you here.
Yeah, I have that with me.
You had a picture here. I'm actually looking at the ad, and you have a bicycle here from Sears. And
right.
I think you also have, this is the same or very similar bike.
Mm-hmm.
And it was $99.99 back in 1978. And here it's $89. So what does that tell us?
Well, I think it tells us that production costs are lower. You know, the washing machine, the clothes washing machine that was $319.95 in 1978, and that's now $319.99. You know, today is
wow.
probably built in Mexico or maybe China or somewhere, and not in, you know, by some highly paid people in Amana, Iowa or somewhere like
right,
that.
Right, right. So why is it that we feel like things are so much more expensive? I mean, certainly when we go to the gas station these days
mm-hmm.
and you know, we're looking at $4 a gallon gas, that feels a whole lot more expensive even than it was 6 or 7 years ago.
Sure. Well, you know, gasoline prices in particular were low for a very long time. At the beginning of 2007, they were really at 1970s levels. And even until a few weeks ago, they were at about 1980, 81 levels.
But they were still that relatively cheap then.
When you adjust for inflation, right.
Huh.
But we use a lot more gas. You know, a Honda Accord now, the current model with the V6 engine, gets about 19 miles per gallon in the city, and it has more horsepower than a 1990 Porsche 911.
Wow.
So, you know, if you wanted a Porsche in 1990, you sort of have one now in the Honda Accord in some ways, but we're using that much more gas. We do consume a lot more. We use more energy, and we live in much bigger houses.
Yeah, you had some really startling statistics on what kinds of houses we are now buying. You know, we think that housing is so expensive these days, and it certainly was during the boom, but part of it is because we're not living in the same kind of houses as we were decades ago.
Not at all. If you look at newly constructed houses in 1970, 74% of houses were one story. Now, 55% of them are two-story houses.
So in general, things are more expensive because we want them to be bigger and better.
But what goes along with that is that we're cheaper as well, in that the average we pay for a private sector employee peaked in 1972. And is now 15% below what it was then.
And this is the whole idea that wages are not keeping up with the cost of living.
No, by and large, wages are going down. And expenses for other things, you know, the share we pay for health insurance or our retirement savings, for instance, are oftentimes dramatically more than they were in the 70s. So all the stuff is cheap, but the stuff that really sustains us really isn't.
So it's the things that we really need that are more expensive and the things we don't need that are still relatively cheap.
Well, I think a lot of us insist we need a three-car garage and, you know, three bathrooms.
Right.
There's a perception of what we need. But if you want to have a comfortable retirement, if you want to pay for your own or a child's education, those things really are a lot more expensive than they used to be.
Peter Hong is a business writer for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for coming in and giving us some perspective.
Thank you, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And this week, Chris, it seems like we finally have some agreement that we are indeed in a recession.
I think you're right, Tess. The recession is here.
Oh, great news. But
I try to brighten things up. Yes.
Thank you so much. But what no one really seems to agree on is how we as individual investors should react to this notion. And, you know, we've gotten all kinds of letters from listeners. I wonder if you might respond to some of these. You mind if I go through these with you?
No, not at all.
All right. First of all, folks speculating on the dollar and whether they should be investing in other currencies.
That's crazy talk.
I agree. What about buying gold?
Now, it's not crazy, but boy, it makes me nervous.
Right. Here's another one. There are some folks who want to actually get into bank stocks right now, even though we just keep getting bad news from the banks.
Oy vey. Tess, here's the straight story. You know, at times like this, it's easy to fall prey to money-making schemes. Problem is, for most of us, these are money-losing schemes.
All right. So basically, crazy talk all around.
I think that's right. Now, if you're wealthy and you're a speculator and you've been doing this for years, sure. But you know what? That's not most of us.
Well, let's expand on a couple of these. First of all, the falling value of the dollar. Lots of people very concerned about this and thinking, well, maybe I should be buying euros or yen.
Right.
Currency speculation is just about one of the worst things you could possibly do, right?
It's a market that is just so hard to understand. I mean, you think the stock market is complicated and the bond market is complicated. Oy. But here's the other thing, Tess. You mentioned, and you're right, we've been getting more and more emails recently.
Yeah.
How long has the dollar been falling?
For a couple of years now.
Couple of years. It's a little bit reminiscent of back in 2005. We're getting emails.
Yeah.
You're saying we shouldn't get in the real estate market, but it's been going up. It's been going up for years, you know, and I'm being left behind. So I have my sort of warning bell going off about when a trend has been in place for a long, long time, you know, you don't want to get in at the very end.
And there's always the possibility that the dollar will, you know, go up.
You know, look, go to Las Vegas. You know, have some entertainment rather than playing in this market.
All right. Well, what about gold? This is, it's almost at $1,000 an ounce. And there's speculation that,
That's right.
That it could be going upwards of $2,000 an ounce. But there's no guarantee, right?
And really, as you, it wasn't that long ago, it was down around $300 an ounce.
Right.
Here's how I would approach gold. If you want to be like the proverbial Swiss banker with their clients, put 2-4% of their clients' assets into gold, and that's catastrophe money. That's fine. But if you're speculating that gold is going to go from 1,000 to 2,000, you know, I would just leave that to the big institutional hedge funds.
Mm-hmm.
Avoid that game.
All right. And bank stocks certainly doesn't seem like the time to get into those.
It doesn't. Now, we know at some point they're going to rally. If someone wants to go in and buy a bunch of bank stocks or a bank stock index and sort of ride it through, that's fine. But let's make sure, again, this is your casino money. You want to play that casino? That's fine, but that's not the type of thing most people should be doing with their money during a recessionary time and volatile markets like we have now.
Well, that certainly begs the question, what the heck should we be doing?
Well, one thing that we should be doing is taking a look at your winners in your portfolio. Rather than looking to losers, is it time to reap some profit? And then you can reallocate some of that profit elsewhere in the market. But the main thing, and I was talking to Jeremy Siegel, Stocks for the Long Run, Wharton finance professor, and he mentioned that there are all these studies that show that the person who sort of buys and holds through a recession actually does better than the person who does a lot of trading. And the reason is quite simple, emotion and fear. Do you understand it when the market goes down 350 points one day and the next day it's up over 400 points? This is whiplash territory. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Something about the Fed chairman injecting billions and billions of dollars into the economy, but you know.
But if we just had advance word of that, but I'm afraid we don't.
All right. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, we'll talk to you later in the show.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Here's something you don't want to hear from your auto mechanic.
Get rid of the car. It has high miles. It's not worth putting money into it.
Knowing when to hold on to a junker and when to let go. That's ahead on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. One of the things that people do in an economic downturn is reevaluate whether they really need that new sweater or couch or car. In fact, a recent study shows people are keeping their cars longer and holding off on new purchases. Selling your car can kind of be like selling a stock. Owners often develop an emotional attachment that keeps them from letting go, even when they really should. So when does it make sense to invest in repairs, and when does your car become a financial liability? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler recently faced that dilemma.
For years, I've been going to the same mechanic in Los Angeles. Issei Automotive is a small, family-run shop in business since 1947. I keep coming back because of the owner, Craig Kurumi. He's the only mechanic I know who consistently tries to talk me out of making repairs. Every conversation begins with the same question.
What are your plans with the car?
And that's what he asks when I bring in my 1998 Subaru Impreza. It has about 180,000 miles on it. And his inspection reveals that the car needs a couple thousand dollars in repairs over the next year.
My first recommendations would be get rid of the car. It has high miles. It's not worth putting money into it.
I take his advice and sell my Subaru. With the money from the sale, plus another $5,000, I upgrade to a 2003 Honda Civic. But that formula doesn't work for everyone. Philip Reed is a consumer advice editor at Edmunds.com.
The thing that people don't really understand is that a car could have, like, no value on the book, but it could be very valuable to you in terms of utility. Does it get you to work and back? And what's it going to cost to replace it?
Reed says people often underestimate the cost of a loan for a new car, which runs about $400 a month for 5 years. On the other hand, he says it might be worth the investment if you're spending a lot to repair the old car.
So if your repair bills over the last 3 months have been anywhere close to $400, it's time to think about replacing that car.
Certain repairs have a reputation for being mechanical black holes. For example, electrical problems can be a money pit. My mechanic, Craig Kurumi, says the same goes for computer issues.
Well, if you have a computer problem, they could run, you know, $1,000 for a new one.
In general, he discourages customers from investing too much in a car with more than 150,000 miles.
Our feeling is it's not worth it to put money into it. Again, depending on what kind of driving you do.
Like driving long distances, driving at night, or in dangerous areas. If that's the kind of driving you do, Kurumi recommends a more dependable set of wheels. But that's not advice he follows himself.
I'm driving a 72 Datsun station wagon.
And how many miles does this have on it?
About 200,000.
He drives the old beater, he says, because he only lives a few miles from work. If it breaks down, he can walk home. And, of course, he knows how to fix it.
I don't have to impress anybody by driving something fancy. I don't care where I park it. Could leave it unlocked.
What if your car isn't even good enough for putt-putting around town? Maybe it's broken and gathering dust in your garage. Don't give up. Philip Reed with Edmunds.com has a friend who owned a 1974 MG that didn't even run.
He was going to pay somebody to haul it away. We put it on Auto Trader and sold it to somebody from the Netherlands for $1,600.
Okay, maybe your old clunker isn't exactly a collector's item. When it's not good for anything else, you can always sell it for the metal. Here at a scrapyard in South Los Angeles, cars aren't for driving, they're for recycling. Just as you might stomp on an old aluminum can, a huge machine smashes old cars. That's the sound of a Mazda being flattened into a metal pancake. Ultimately, these ferrous flapjacks may get shipped to India or China to feed their appetites for industrial metal. That demand has pushed up commodity prices, making your old jalopy more valuable. Jose Cortez is a scrap dealer.
The car we pay by a ton, so right now the car body is going for $130 a ton.
That's about $150 to $200 per car. Of course, you could always donate your car to a worthy cause, but beware. Charity Navigator advises donors to avoid organizations that rely on middlemen, since they often profit more than the charities. And if you're in it for the tax deduction, note that the rules have changed. Blue Book estimates are out, so get a receipt from the charity. The IRS has been clamping down. Overestimate the value of your old car at your own risk, or you may be the one who gets crushed. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
So much basic personal finance advice bears repeating, and that's what we do on this show. Max out your retirement, pay down credit card debt, save money. Well, like so many things in life, it pays to keep your financial plan simple. And for some helpful tips, we turn to Leslie Alderman of Real Simple Magazine. Leslie, you know, the problem here seems to start with us spending too much money. What's the simple solution?
stop spending so much money. No, right. Easier said than done. What we did write about, just to make people feel better, is that they're not crazy. And it's that, you know, shopping, especially for things that aren't fun, like things for your home or clothes or even delicious food, you know, really makes you feel good. There's a chemical that gets released in your brain, dopamine. So there's kind of a rush. So, you know, in some ways we were born to shop. It just feels good. What you have to do is just sort of ratchet it back. And one thing that's very helpful is just to give yourself a budget on things where you feel a little bit out of control and say, I'm only going to spend $200 a month on clothes.
All right. And worry number two, and I think this is common for both your readers and our listeners, we save too little money. What's the best piece of advice there?
I think what's most helpful if you feel like you're really saving too little is to focus on why you want to save more and make this something very realistic. Because if you have this amorphous thing, I should be saving for retirement, I should be saving for an emergency fund, it feels kind of vague and abstract, and things in the present are much more tantalizing, like, you know, a new coat.
Right.
You're saving for a concrete goal.
And get really specific about it, it sounds like.
Get really specific. And maybe your goal is, I don't want to have those creditors calling me all the time.
Right.
Your goal is to relieve the stress of credit card debt. But I think it's also, you know, you have to be practical too. And one of the best things is to just set up automatic savings accounts where you can't withdraw money that's not there in your account. You know, sort of out of sight is out of mind. And that is, you know, probably the hands down easiest way to get yourself to save more money.
We've seen oil go over $100 a barrel, and that inevitably will filter down into our gas tanks. What are some of the suggestions you have for at least trying to tamp down on that particular expense?
One of the things that we tell readers to do is to go to this great website called gasbuddy.com and enter your zip code and look for the stations that are in your area, and you will find this wide range of prices. And so, you know, make it a habit of going and filling up at the station with the cheapest prices. I mean, another thing that we said is don't park in the hot sun, because guess what? Gas will evaporate. So park in the shade when possible.
Of course, all of this comes down to the question of whether you really have a financial plan for your life. And a lot of people don't. How do they go about starting one?
A financial plan can be as simple as sitting down by yourself or with your partner or spouse and saying, this is what I want to do with my hard-earned money. It's setting some kind of priorities and then backing up from there and saying, is the way that I'm spending my money in alignment with those goals? Barring that, you really can't underestimate the value of an outsider, aka a financial planner, and really helping you go through your goals and making sure that the way you're spending your money and using your money is really in alignment with what you want to get out of life.
All right. We've been talking about the article titled Your Biggest Money Worries Solved, and you can find it in the March issue of Real Simple Magazine. And we've been talking with Leslie Alderman, who's the deputy editor there. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveand.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
It's time once again for Getting Personal, and that is when we answer your money questions. With me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell, and our first caller is Margaret, and she's in Northfield, Minnesota. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
So what's your question for Chris today?
My fiance and I are first-time home buyers, and I wanted to put a large down payment on the house. And years ago, I inherited money from my grandfather, and the money was invested in the stock market. I wanted now to use that money to make this down payment, but I have been advised to put the stock on margin in order to take out the $43,000 that I wanted to use as a down payment instead of selling the stock outright.
Oh, my.
But I don't really understand what it means to margin, and I'm interested in knowing what the risks are of margining the stock and if you think it's a good idea.
All right, Chris. Well, let's start with the very basics. What does it mean if you're selling a stock on margin?
Well, what it means is you take this stock that she has, say $43,000 worth of stock, and rather than selling the stock, she's going to borrow against the value of that stock. And my immediate reaction is no,
okay.
No. And no. And
that's pretty clear.
There are a couple of reasons why. First reason is you don't really understand what margining is.
Right.
And right now what's happening on Wall Street is a lot of firms are getting into financial trouble because they're getting what are called margin calls. They borrowed against the value of an asset, say stock, but you have to keep a relationship between what you borrowed and the value of that asset. So that's the value of that asset's declining, like the value of your stock.
Right.
The people who lent you the money, they get nervous. They're going to call you up and say, you got to put in some more money in here. And if you don't, they're going to sell the stock out from under you.
Margaret, who advised you to do this?
Well, it was primarily my dad. Okay. And his income is significantly higher than ours is.
He can take the risk more
right.
easily than you can.
Risk. Right.
Is this something where they could simply just sell the stocks then and use that as a down payment?
That would be my advice. I mean, the reason why your father may be saying don't sell is the market is down, as you mentioned, plus you will pay capital gains taxes
right.
more than likely. So, you know, you take a hit that way.
All right. Does that help you out, Margaret?
Oh, tremendously. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, not sure if you're making a huge mistake with a big purchase. Do let us help. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, we received many phone calls and emails about a straight story from a couple of weeks ago. Wanted to
yes.
get your take on this. We were talking at the time about TIPS, Treasury Inflation-Protected Securities. Within that straight story, you mentioned that cash is a great hedge against inflation.
Okay.
We had many listeners who wrote in who were very confused by your comment, including Matthew from Nashville, Tennessee. He said he always thought cash was a poor hedge against inflation. What do you say?
When I read comments like from Matthew and other people, you know, palm of your hand hitting against your forehead. Oh, I always try not to use jargon, but every once in a while it slips in. So I use cash in the Wall Street sense, and that means money market mutual funds, treasury bills, your short-term fixed income securities. Now, here's the relationship. When inflation is picking up steam, typically, interest rates rise, right? Mm-hmm. And so if that happens, then the reason why cash, as I've just defined it, is a hedge against inflation is that your short-term interest rates also rise.
So you're getting a good return.
You're getting a good return. But I want to add another point. And this comes from William Flickenstein. He's a hedge fund manager out in Seattle. And he made an interesting point. He said, look, you know, at times like this, cash, as I've defined it now, the Wall Street jargon term cash, is very valuable because it gives you a buying opportunity. You have something that a lot of other people don't. You have buying power. And during a recession, a downturn, buying power is king.
Okay, but let's just make this crystal clear for everyone. We are not talking about dollar bills and change.
You're absolutely right.
Let's move on to another email. And Richard writes in from Penns Creek, Pennsylvania, and he's been investing in closed-end funds for about 25 years. So he wants to know what the difference is between a closed-end fund and an exchange-traded fund.
Okay, very quickly, both of them, closed-end fund, exchange-traded fund, limited number of shares.
Okay.
Both of them are traded on an exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the difference. The closed-end fund owns a portfolio of some sort of securities, stocks, bonds, real estate.
Okay.
The exchange-traded fund represents an index, such as the Standard & Poor's 500.
All right. Well, if you're unclear about a money term, we'll break things down. Do give us a call. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link and stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. St. Paddy's Day is this week. For many, it's an excuse to carouse at the local watering hole, be ye Irish or otherwise. But for Irish-born Americans, it can be a time to think about how far they've come from the old country. So on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we pay a visit to an Irish woodworker here in California. These days, his business earns him as much as $85,000 a year. It's a long way from his childhood in Northern Ireland.
My name is Gabriel McKegney. I am an artisan woodworker. I design and manufacture hardwood furnishings. With wood, there aren't certainties. It will move, it will warp, it will expand, it will contract. Good woodworkers are usually people who sense what the material will do and move and encourage it in a direction knowing that it may not fully cooperate. The first few times I did it, it shook me that I was able to create these things. I can remember once doing a handrail in a custom home, using mathematics, using geometry, trying to figure out the right way to make the turning on the handrail. And then I had a bandsaw right on the staircase with me, and I started to ignore the mathematics and just go through this simple process of trusting my hands. And instinctively, within an amazing 15 minutes, I had the piece shaped, and it was perfect. You know, I was shaken after because I thought, wow, I just did that. Having come out to Southern California and worked in these large, beautiful homes, I just see a real need, a real lack of good architectural woodwork in there. I have tailor-made my business to try and supply some of that very traditional styled pieces that I see a demand for. Well, we didn't benefit from the boom because we were busy developing our business, and we're not concerned greatly with the recession for two reasons. One is I've been in a recession for most of my life, and this is not a recession compared to where I come from in Northern Ireland. This is a hiccup. And secondly, actually, is that we produce products that are now attractive and affordable, even in a tougher marketplace. This is computerized carving. It's a router that's driven by computer programs. Hand carving it is only 10% of the work. It's so difficult manufacturing furniture in Southern California or in America anymore. The only way we're able to do it is because we have automated and we have this faster system of producing parts. I made a Louis XV fireplace reproduction about 4 or 5 years ago after a lot of experts telling me I would never find enough of the English walnut to make a big fire mantel. I did. The gentleman that I made it for asked me, he said, "Gabe, if you can design up, design up. I want this to be so great." And that was the wrong thing to tell me. That added another 6 months to the project. Here's the biggest surprise between my father and I. And I don't think he knows this. When he saw the fireplace, I think he had no words, because I had just exceeded anything he imagined. I think he realized I just went beyond anything they dreamed.
You'll find pictures of that fireplace at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Caitlin Carroll. Coming up, our fear and loathing of mathematics is often learned in school.
You could have one instance, one teacher who called on you when your hand was not raised and sent you to the blackboard to solve a problem that you didn't understand.
Find out how math anxiety keeps us from getting ahead on our personal finances. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Viglund. The summer concert season is upon us, or at least the ticket buying stage of it is. I see the Police will be here at the Hollywood Bowl in May. Perhaps it's time to get online. If you've bought a ticket to a concert or a sporting event lately, you might have experienced a bit of sticker shock. There are the service fees, shipping charges, facility fees. Sometimes they'll even charge you to print out the ticket on your own computer with your own paper. But at least one entrepreneur in Seattle is trying to bring down ticket costs while bands bring down the house. From the Emerald City, Ann Dornfeld reports.
The ASAP Rock Show is about to begin at the Showbox Theater in downtown Seattle. Fans of the underground rapper say they were happy to pay $20 to see him play.
Yeah, I went down on my lunch break just to get tickets for this show.
That's Miles. He went across town to buy tickets at the box office. He didn't have to. He could have bought online through Ticketmaster. But he was determined to not give any money to the industry leader.
They overcharge. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, you're going to spend like $8 extra.
That's $8 in service fees for each $20 ticket. The fees go even higher, too. Take a Sonics basketball game. A cheap seat at Key Arena is $10. If you buy it on the Ticketmaster website, you'll pay a convenience charge of $3. To print out the ticket at home is another $2.50. Then there's an order processing charge of $4. Add tax, and the final cost is $1,977. The ticket price has doubled. Stan Sucher is a professor of music and entertainment industry studies at the University of Colorado. He says Ticketmaster cornered the market in the 1970s when it created a computerized national ticketing system. Customers could now go to the grocery store to pick up tickets for a concert or ball game.
Really, Ticketmaster was also very successful in striking up licensing deals where they realized that they would charge a service fee of the consumer. And then to get a licensing deal with a venue, Ticketmaster would offer a rebate where some of that service charge would go back to the venue.
As a result, Ticketmaster has contracts with most of the nation's large concert venues and stadiums. Over the years, that's led to charges of monopolistic practices from bands like Pearl Jam, REM, and String Cheese Incident. They demanded more freedom to sell their own tickets with lower service fees. Pearl Jam's complaint was tossed out. String Cheese settled out of court. Even sports teams have gotten involved. The Cleveland Cavaliers basketball team has a federal antitrust lawsuit pending against Ticketmaster. But Sucher says Ticketmaster's greatest threat is probably the loss of its contract with concert promoter Live Nation at the end of this year.
Ticketmaster, they're losing 10% of their business when they lose Live Nation. So what'll be interesting to see is as Live Nation moves out on their own in terms of selling tickets and can become a competitor to Ticketmaster, will there be more of a flexibility in the services? Will they go down in a more competitive atmosphere?
Ticketmaster officials declined to speak on tape for this story, but they say a lot of those service fees pay for the company's technology costs. Steve Butcher says that doesn't make sense. He's co-founder and CEO of one Ticketmaster competitor, the Seattle company Brown Paper Tickets.
With technology, the cost of delivering the same services over the years has gone way down, but the fees have gone up.
Butcher says his company's anti-fraud technology is similar to what Ticketmaster uses, that on a $10 ticket, Brown Paper charges just a $1.24 service fee. Butcher says he keeps costs down by rejecting the standard ticketing business model. That means no 3 to 10 year exclusive contracts with venues like Ticketmaster has. And Brown Paper doesn't negotiate service fees. At first, that was a hard concept to explain to venues.
One of the first things they'd ask before they signed up was, how much of the service fee can we get back? We said, well, actually, no, you just increase your price to get what you need, and we keep our service fee. But what people wanted was for us to charge $5 in service fees, and then they get $3 back, because that's what they were used to.
Butcher has built up his company by focusing on the smaller venues that the ticket industry usually ignores, providing tickets for film festivals, burlesque shows, and lectures. He estimates the company will handle about 30,000 events in the next year, still about a third of the number Ticketmaster handles. In order to win over major venues, the company will have to convince promoters to charge more for tickets and not demand a cut of the service fees. Meanwhile, consumers like Miles are pretty much resigned to shelling out for those fees.
I've never really not gone to a show based on the price, because if I want to go see a show, I will and just find the best way to do it. If it's through Ticketmaster, fine, I'll do it. But it's like that's the least desirable way to do it.
The best way to avoid a convenience fee is still to inconvenience yourself and buy in person at the box office. For Marketplace Money, I'm Ann Dornfeld in Seattle.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Hook, Line, and Sinker brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, smishing. It sounds and smells like the email scam known as phishing, except it happens on your cell phone. Spammers pretending to be banks or finance sites send a phony text message. You take the bait and send back passwords, social security numbers, or other personal information. Cell phone companies are trying to crack down on smishing through lawsuits. Verizon Wireless reportedly filters more than 200 million spam text messages a month, but some manage to wriggle away. So if the next text message you get seems fishy, don't bite.
back again with Getting Personal. And as always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, we've got an email from Jeffrey in College Station, Texas. He considers himself what's called a lazy investor.
Which is a good thing, because typically that means you own like index funds and you're not a very active trader. So it can be a very smart approach.
Well, that's exactly what he says he does. He says he uses index funds and a percentage of assets for what he hopes is a balanced portfolio. But he wants to know how often he should rebalance to these predetermined percentages. First of all, let's give a really basic definition of what lazy investing is.
A lazy investor just wants to be smart over the long haul about how much they have in stocks, how much they have in bonds, and then every once in a while check in and make sure that their fund is doing okay. So it's a real focus on, jargon term here, asset allocation. How much in stocks, how much in bonds, and then once you've really put all your work and research into that, then you're just doing some monitoring, no buying, no selling, no trading.
But how about this question of how often you check it and change things?
Okay. Let's say you were 50% stocks, 50% bonds. We're going to keep it real simple. And just because the way the world has worked, you're now 60% stocks, 40% bonds. You want to get back to your 50-50. That's what all the rebalancing does. That's what he's asking about. So you can do it once a year. Now, usually for most people, that's not enough. Some people do it quarterly. And then other people are a little more active. They'll typically say, if my asset allocation gets out of whack by 10%, that's when I make my move. So it's not by the calendar. It's by how much the markets are moving. If I get a 10% move, then I'm going to go in there and do my rebalancing.
All right. Well, whether you are a lazy investor or, Lord help us, a stock market daredevil, let us help with your portfolio. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Sean is with us from beautiful Honolulu, Hawaii. How's it hanging there, Sean?
Things are going well, Tess. Thanks.
Yeah. How's the surf?
Surf's nice.
Can I come visit?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I understand that you have a question today that you're asking on behalf of your mother. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, my mom went to a conference where they told her about some business opportunities, as it were. And when she told me about them, she was really excited, and they sounded a little bit fishy to me. They told her about a couple of things. One was a way to buy tax liens through, you know, their special program. And another one was a way to protect your assets through something called a charitable remainder trust and a family limited partnership.
Oh, my goodness.
And when I asked her some questions, which I thought might be important, she said that they hadn't really mentioned any of that stuff. So it kind of bothered me.
Well, Chris, I think instead of the Hawaiian music, we're going to need to go to the sirens.
Yeah.
All kinds of red flags going up here.
All kinds. These, I've been to a number of these conferences, very similar to what your mom went to. And they're not scams in the sense of being illegal, in the traditional sense that we'll use the word scam. But what they're products that are sold but should not be bought. They're very expensive. My bottom line advice to anybody who's tempted to go to one of these seminars, stay away from them, because what they're selling is that Uncle Sam won't tax you. Or, yeah, you can make 50% on your money off of people who have fallen into trouble with their homes. And, you know, if any of these programs really worked the way that they're pitched, we'd all be rich.
So Sean, is this something that your mother has already made the investment?
Well, unfortunately, she did make an investment in a couple of these things, and they claim that they are full get your money back. And as soon as I heard about it, I urged her to try and get her money back as much as she could. But hopefully she actually can.
Yeah. Did they set any sort of time limit on getting her money back?
On one of the programs that she bought into, they had a 3-day time limit.
Uh-oh.
And I haven't talked to her since, but I believe that she tried to get her money back within that time period.
Okay. Chris, do you know in general, legally, are they required to give you your money back if you change your mind?
What they have to do is state what is the program. You have 3 days, you have a week, you have 2 weeks. They have a fair amount of latitude as long as it's clearly understood. Now, the elderly can get some extra protections. And so I think it's great that she's trying to get her money back. And here's the real thing. even if you can't get all your money back, don't put good money after bad. Just write it off, move away, walk on.
All right. Does that help you out, Sean?
It helps me out quite a bit. I will all make right. sure to let my mother know.
Good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, unfortunately, Chris, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But as we've been telling folks, you are now answering their personal finance questions every weekday online. Just visit our website. It's at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Confession time. A couple of weeks ago, I made a major math boo-boo on the air in front of millions of people. I was calculating a percentage, and I forgot to move the decimal point over two places. Listeners wrote in to chide me for getting sixth grade math wrong. Believe it or not, I actually got A's and B's in the subject, but for many, many people, math is just scary. But you can't go through life without it. The National Mathematics Advisory Panel issued a report this week saying students who complete Algebra 2 are more than twice as likely to graduate from college. It did recommend that students be required to learn fewer math topics, but to learn them more in depth. Here to talk math and finance is Jean Chatsky. She's the author of Make Money, Not Excuses. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
How many of us are truly affected by what you might call math anxiety?
When it comes to women, the numbers go as high as half, and I've seen different pieces of research on the subject. Men tend to be a little bit less affected, but the problem is that this starts very, very early in childhood. You could have one instance, one teacher who called on you when your hand was not raised and sent you to the blackboard to solve a problem that you didn't understand. You get embarrassed, you get very shy of the math very quickly, and it only takes once, but the ramifications can actually last for a lifetime.
If you have decided either in your head or found out for real that you're not good at math, how does that affect you in your personal finances?
It can be serious because you tend to avoid dealing with your money. And if we're avoiding dealing with the money because we don't like to look at the numbers, then we're not opening our statements. We're not saving and calculating what it might cost us to live in retirement, and we're going to end up down the line with a huge shortfall.
When we talk about math anxiety in relation to personal finances, are we talking about folks being afraid of even, you know, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division? Or are we talking, you know, you can't calculate something to the fourth power off the top of your head?
I think that the fear tends to be of the fourth power. But what people don't realize is that the sort of math that was required in the classroom is not at all the sort of math that is required in real life.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of math that you need for money is addition, subtraction, multiplication, percentages, and fractions. And that's it.
Percentages and fractions. I think that's where you might get people.
Okay, but we all have shortcuts that are available to us that were not available to other generations. Every one of us these days carries around a cell phone, and there's a calculator in there. So we should be pulling out the calculators and using them. Or if we don't like to balance our checkbooks, then we should be banking online and letting the bank run all of those computations that we want to avoid for us.
Aside from getting yourself a financial advisor, what are some other steps that you can take if you're one of the, if you're a math phobic and you just really don't feel comfortable with working with your own finances?
Small steps can be very, very helpful. A lot of local colleges, a lot of even local community colleges these days offer remedial math courses. The internet can also be a great tool. If you can get yourself to one or more of the retirement calculators, you run yourself through a few of them and you start to get sort of a consensus opinion of how much money you are going to need to have to afford the sort of retirement that you are thinking in your mind you might want. Lastly, if you are not certain, don't let that stop you from starting to save. Go ahead and save some money and put it in a life cycle fund or a target date retirement fund. That's a mutual fund set up to essentially manage itself toward your retirement date. And these funds can truly be a lifesaver because they are for all those people out there who just don't get up to the plate to make their own decisions.
It seems like our financial lives, that's kind of one area of ourselves that we don't share a lot with friends. You kind of talk about anything but money. But I wonder if that's also a way for you to kind of get over the math phobias. Talking to other people who probably have the same issues, and maybe you can learn together.
I think that's absolutely right. I actually saw a piece of research that came out from the Consumer Federation of America and Wachovia. It looked at savings and the fact that more than half of the people in this country are not saving adequately. When it looked at the drivers of good saving behavior, 80% of people said communicating about financial goals, communicating about our money and what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong was actually a huge help in getting moving in the right direction.
Jean Chatsky is the author of Make Money, Not Excuses. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, planning out your financial future means facing harsh realities, especially when it comes to buying a home.
So based on your income and your current ability to save and your expenses, you're really looking at probably an 8 to 9 year plan, unless Mr. Wonderful comes into your life and has an income with you.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Janae Darden, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.